From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. There are blood and guts on Wall Street, metaphorically, of course, but that's not the only stain this ongoing crisis has left. Some politically conservative red states are turning blue. Plus, Chicago's sheriff says he's not going to evict rent-paying tenants from foreclosed properties. For more on this week's headlines, we're going to start our conversation with Deirdre Childress. She's the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend Magazine. How are you?
I'm great today. How are you?
So tell me a little bit about what you think of this move that has been making just a huge amount of headlines, that the sheriff in Chicago basically says, if you are a rent-paying tenant, you should not be thrown out by his officers.
Well, I think that people who have been renting have been paying in good faith. And I think that it's emblematic of the problems in our country right now, because we are not giving people the grace that they deserve. If someone's been paying their mortgage and they've been paying their rent, and then they can't even have a few months to get themselves together to get moved out. In a lot of these cases in Chicago, people had no idea that they were paying their rent to someone who was not making their mortgage payments. And I think it kind of underscores some of the problems that we're going to have. And one in particular is the issue of homelessness and how it's increasing because our economy is failing right now.
Well, let's take a little bit of listen to Sheriff Thomas Dart speaking on CNN.
We're seeing more people renting homes and renting condos than ever. And what's happening now is they are paying all of their rent. They're paying all of the things that they're supposed to do. They're paying on time. And then all of a sudden, someone shows up at the door and says, listen, you and your family are out on the street today. And we're seeing that time and time again. And they have no notice. They have no anything. Mm-hmm. And this is an example of where the banking industry has not done any of the work they should do. It's a piece of paper to them. And these poor people are seeing everything they own put out on the street.
Deirdre, I'm actually going to bring someone else in. Cynthia Pryor Hardy has a talk show, On Point with Cynthia, that airs from Columbia, South Carolina. How are you doing, Cynthia?
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me again today, and hello, Deirdre.
So what about this case of the Cooks County Sheriff saying, mm-hmm. I'm not evicting people?
You know, at a point, people's human side just comes out. You know, we're in such a mess right now, and you know, it's one of those things where the whole system has run amok. And, you know, I think it'd be hard-pressed to not find other people in law enforcement that might take a similar stance, just simply because it's a situation that seems to be out of control.
How are things going in your area, in and around Columbia, in terms of foreclosures? Have they ramped up, slowed down, stayed the same since we came out and visited you during the primary season?
Since you were here during the primary, it's increased a lot. You know, people are distressed and, you know, they don't really know what to do. Credit is drying up. So not only are they looking at the value of their homes decreasing, they're also looking at not having very many options, not very many alternatives for doing anything to adjust what they have currently. And so as a result, they're in a pickle. They're in a real pickle. People are very, very frustrated. You know, we all heard and we all felt it when we heard about the woman in her 90s that took matters into her own hands and shot herself because she was so distraught over being evicted. Well, you can imagine how law enforcement must feel having to go and turn someone like that out of their homes, realizing that this is the little man. This isn't the person that's responsible for the mess that we have, but it's certainly one of the casualties. So yeah, we've got problems down here in South Carolina.
Deirdre, Pennsylvania is one of these big swing states. People are courting Pennsylvanians' votes. How is the mortgage crisis playing out with people's perceptions?
I think that it really is hurting people in their pocketbook, and I think, as she was just saying, there are not a lot of options once you hit rock bottom anymore. There's no place to go. Across the river, right in Sicklerville, New Jersey, which has the highest foreclosure rate in this area, my brother lives in that area, and he actually tells me that you can just drive through and see the number of homes that have been foreclosed on. They moved into a new neighborhood about 5 years ago where they knew all their neighbors. They were all excited. And now, one by one, we see these homes that were valued at $400,000 turning over, and there's a couple instances where two or three families are living in those homes.
So what about the political ramifications of this? Are you getting any signs, and I'm going to go to you first, Cynthia, that this crisis has been strengthening the Democrats' hands? Because when you look at these election maps, you're seeing that a lot of the swing states across the nation seem to be going into the Democratic territory.
You're absolutely right. And even some of the states that are not characterized as swing states, we are still characterized as a red state. But I think you got to watch South Carolina. You know, the Democrats are really hoping to ride this tide of Obama and ride this tide of uncertainty. And you're seeing people line up all over the place. A number of people are beginning to predict in South Carolina that our Republican-dominated state might be turned on its ear, because what you're looking at is a movement that's being fueled by this terrible, terrible economy, and people don't know. They're fretful, and they recognize that they feel a little helpless in the situation to get something changed or done because they've trusted for 8 years in something that didn't work. And so, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see how this national movement that is occurring across our country actually impacts states like South Carolina. You know, Pariah, our Republican chairman told the National Republican Party that they didn't need any money being spent in South Carolina because they could deliver South Carolina for McCain in November. Well, you know, I don't know that they feel as strongly as they do with the last couple of weeks with the economic indicators being what they are. So I think it's anybody's, you know, I think it could go, and I think a lot of states could turn. Certainly South Carolina, one that people have thought was definitely in the R column, might not be.
Deirdre, what have you seen in terms of the final push to the elections? We're doing a month-long series on elections, talking about voter registration, talking about new voters, which you'll hear more about in just a few minutes. What kind of trends have you seen overall about what make this election different from 4 years ago or 8 years ago?
I think just the unpredictable elements, as Cynthia was just saying, the states that turned over that you don't expect, the campaigning that you don't expect. If you look at the map from September 21st, in the last few weeks, Obama has picked up a lot of states that previously were won by George Bush in 2004. States like Virginia, North Carolina, possibly Ohio and Nevada. And I think that's really interesting. And what we're seeing in Pennsylvania is tomorrow is going to be called the Pennsylvania Saturday. Obama's going to be in four neighborhoods. He's going to be talking to people that don't usually have access to politics. He's going to really tour Philadelphia, which, you know, has always called itself a city of neighborhoods. Then as the weekend moves on Sunday and Monday, we'll have both the Clintons coming to Pennsylvania, to Scranton, to Joe Biden's hometown to talk to folks. And then we have a big battleground Saturday in the city when McCain and Sarah Palin are here. In particular, Sarah Palin is going to drop the puck at the Flyers game home opener tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So the quintessential hockey mom is coming to Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of states that are still in play, or people believe there's a chance that they can be swung in. I think that's going to be what's really interesting over the next 3 weeks or so.
Let's cycle back to the economy. Cynthia, you own a small business, a media business, with your husband. Have you been affected personally?
Oh, I think that the uncertainty is what's affecting people more than anything now. My husband is fond of saying to me and other business owners, don't panic. When you see the indicators as they are, stay steady. And the reason Jim says that is because we see the run that we have right now, on the market. And when that occurs, everything is helter-skelter. We are concerned about our levels of credit, because we run a full-service advertising agency. We buy billboards. You know how expensive media is to buy. You know, so oftentimes we have to float debt, and you got to keep your inventory up, and you got to keep your employees paid. And a lot of times, even though you are well-capitalized, the cash flow is something that you have to be concerned about. And quite frankly, people don't pay on time when the economy is bad. They hold on to the money longer than they normally do, so the money kind of chugs along as opposed to flowing very, very fluidly. And so, yes, we're seeing it. We don't anticipate having to make any major changes right now, but I can tell you, we're hunkering down. We are getting rid of space that we don't need. A storage room that costs $500 can be eliminated because you can stick that stuff under your desk.
Right. Time to be practical.
That's right.
Deirdre, what about on your side? You're not running your own business, but you are dealing with the fact that you work in an industry that's not a lot of margin right now, the media industry. Have you seen any signs, not necessarily where you work, but among the media companies that you and your friends work at, that things are going to tighten up a bit?
Oh, they're definitely tightening up. You know, just today, I'm the national secretary for the Black Journalists. And just today on our listserv, people were talking about ideas and ways to pull together to get freelance work.
Wow.
Nobody is counting on being in, you know, a national media giant for all of their career anymore. They're figuring out how to get the basic parts of their lives together piecemeal, you know, a little bit of money from this publication, another little bit of money from that publication. And we're going to have to get together and figure out how to reinvent ourselves. I'm on a panel that's working on that issue right now. And what I realized is that it's not just journalists. It's that people in America, in many jobs, in many walks of life, have to figure out how to capture some of the things that we need to change and how to make them change for you. And I think reinvention is going to be a big buzzword and very important as we look at how our country changes, how our industry changes, and then we look at our place in the global economy.
Absolutely. Well, ladies, thank you and have a great weekend.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Deirdre Childress, the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend magazine. She's also the national secretary for the National Association of Black Journalists. She joined us from Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. And South Carolina talk radio host Cynthia Pryor Hardy of On Point with Cynthia. She joined us from the studios of WLTR in Columbia, South Carolina. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This historic election has inspired a flood of newly registered voters. But who are they? What's motivating them to cast their ballots? We'll take a look at three new voters to find out. First, we're going to talk about national voter trends with Kareem Creighton. He's an associate professor of law and political science at the University of Southern California. Kareem, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So, new voters. One demographic, many different types of people. What are we looking at?
Many different types of people. They are as diverse, I think, as the country is. They include young voters. They include people who have been disaffected, who haven't voted in the last few elections. They include some older voters as well. And, of course, you have newly naturalized citizens who are voting for the first time.
We're going to talk to a couple of types of those voters, but it's harder to find the disaffected voters. They seem to keep a very low profile, except for some rappers who say, okay, I never voted before, but maybe I'll vote this time around. Do you think that there is a groundswell of people who may be disaffected voters, particularly people who have been eligible to vote in past elections but simply have chosen not to, who may come out this time?
Certainly so. There actually has been one survey recently that the Wall Street Journal and NBC did to identify some of those lapsed voters and ask them a number of questions about how they're viewing the election. They represent, if you combine them with new voters, about 10% of the electorate, and many of them have a lot of cynicism, not surprisingly, toward federal government, and have a lot of expectations of what a new administration might do. And so this election, partly because of the issues, partly because of the candidates involved, is likely to bring out a lot of new people, I think, who haven't been involved in the electorate in the past.
Let's just be frank here. Are we mainly talking about Democrats and Obama supporters? Because there's also information that shows that most of the new voter registration that's gone on that is for one of the two major parties is Democratic registration. Is this something that benefits one party more than the other?
Well, I think it is fair to say that the lion's share of these new and lapsed voters, that we call them, have been inclined towards voting for Barack Obama. The numbers suggest that he's about 65 to 30 in terms of the percentage of people who prefer him over John McCain. But I don't think it's necessarily the case that they are Democrats per se. I think these are people who don't really have a particular view of one party or the other. They want new policies that benefit them. They are concerned about the economy, and they want whoever is out there who's going to be responsive to their concerns.
When you have a group of people, whether it's new voters who really just, you know, literally just turned 18 and can't wait to get to the polls, or people who are disaffected non-voters, what kind of messaging do you think appeals to these groups? What kind of messaging might campaigns be putting out to reach these groups?
Right. Well, it's tied in part to the comment I just made earlier, which is they don't necessarily buy into the my party's better than your party argument. Instead, what they're looking for is a response to real problems. If you look at the different set of issues that they think are most important, the economy is the biggest concern. And it's something, obviously, that has national ramifications, but it also hits people right at home in the pocketbook. And so they are looking for the candidates who respond to those concerns. And so the parties, in trying to frame a message, I think are going to, and they have so far, try to make the argument that this candidate and the policies that they are for would be good for America, but they benefit you specifically for the following three or four reasons. And so that's, I think, messaging. That's the message that both of these candidates, I think, are trying to articulate in the last few days before the election.
How reliable are first-time and new voters?
And there's the rub. It unfortunately is not as great a yield as you might expect. The same poll I was referring to earlier asked new voters and lapsed voters, how interested are you in this election, very or not? The very side got about 49%, and only about 54% said they were definitely going to vote in the election. So there's a lot of money put into getting these people on the voting rolls as registered voters. It's not necessarily a one-to-one connection between the registered voter and the actual voter that comes out on election day. But they're going to pour lots of money on both sides to get these folks out to vote. They've identified them. They've found new and innovative ways of doing that. So they're going to pour money into getting them out on election day as much as they can.
Give me an example, because I know that a lot of people question whether or not the polls have reflected new voters, because so many people now are using cell phones only and there's no home number. So how are you and other political scientists, as well as the political parties, trying to track people down?
Right. Well, some of the ways in which people have tried to kind of expand the pie beyond the typical likely voter is to use things like the internet. So a lot of polls have tried to specifically identify a lot of these voters by going where they live. Young voters tend to use the internet a lot more than others, and so typically we try to incorporate that into the analysis. The other benefit actually that has happened over the course of time is that the government itself has done a better job of keeping track of people when they register and whether or not they're voting. So it's easier to put together a list of people who are in that category of lapsed voters if you just look back at a pretty easy, you know, electronic database of people who have at least been registered to vote but maybe haven't voted since early 2000 or perhaps even the late 1990s.
Well, Professor, thanks.
You're quite welcome.
That was Kareem Creighton. He's an associate professor of law and political science at the University of Southern California. He joined us from our studios here at NPR West. But what about the folks who are standing in voting lines for the first time? We have got three of them, each with a different cut on politics. Amel Bennett Judge is president of the Howard University Democrats. Reginald Darby is vice president of the Howard University Republicans. And Mary Nanama Donkwa of Hollywood just became a citizen of the United States. Thanks, guys, for coming on the show.
Wow.
Thank you.
We definitely appreciate this.
Yeah. So, Mary, I guess it's not quite fresh, but it's close. It's, you know, it's in recent history you got naturalized. Was the idea that you would be a voter as a former Ghanaian citizen, was becoming an American something that you did in part to vote?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, as you know, before you become a citizen, you do have a green card, a permanent resident status. So it is possible to live legally but not have the right to vote. So for me, that was definitely one of the reasons why I decided to become a citizen.
You have a child here. You have, of course, a career here, friends, all that. And did you have any regret when you had to make that choice? I mean, first of all, did you have to give up your Ghanaian citizenship?
No, Ghana recognizes dual citizenship, so...
Some people do, some people don't.
Yeah, so it is actually possible, since they're having an election, for me to get on a plane and go there and vote as well.
That's a lot of work to get your responsibilities all taken care of. What's your investment in this election?
Like anyone else, it's the economy. I'm a single mother and have a child that's about to go to college, and buying groceries is becoming more and more of a challenge. Keeping a roof over one's head is becoming more and more of a challenge. So certainly that, certainly that.
All right, I'm going to turn to our students. We've got two folks from Howard University,
yes.
HBCU.
Yes. HU.
Yep, Democrats.
And Republicans.
Republicans.
Definitely Republican.
All right, speaking from different sides of the aisle, I'm going to start with you, Reginald.
Awesome.
First of all, what's your level of excitement about being in your first presidential race?
Wow, you just don't imagine. I remember way back in 2000 when I actually sat in front of my TV and I was watching the whole Al Gore Bush election. My mom, who's a huge Democrat, and back then I thought I was one too. I'll just sit there and it's like, oh my gosh, who's going to do this? What state's going to be there? Oh, this is red, this is purple, this is blue. What does purple mean? But now that I actually understand what's going on and I know that I can make that difference by casting my vote and encouraging others to do the same, then there's nothing stopping me now. I'm so ecstatic.
Yesterday we had on Michael Steele, the former lieutenant governor of
Maryland,
a big hit at the Republican convention, mm-hmm. and he talked a little bit about what he thought the fortunes of the party would be and of, you know, sort of opportunities for black Republicans or for the Republican Party to really get black voters. He was not hopeful, but you remain faithful. Why?
Absolutely. For a simple fact, I say it as this. I go to Howard University, which is a very liberal school. However, we have outlets such as the city of Washington, D.C., being that that's where we're based at, where we can learn about the different opportunities that the Republican Party offers. And also, we're able to have a different perspective. Right now, I currently work for the House Republican Conference. And as I work in that office, I see every day the different type of benefits that could work with the African-American community. For me personally, I was able to work not only, like I said, with the House Republican Conference, but with individuals within throughout the community. And I know, like, my mom, for example, she's a single parent who makes a certain amount of money a year, not much, but she's still considered middle class America. But different issues like health care, education, which affects me, they all connect back to the Republican Party. And if I'm able to address that, and if I'm able to continuously live by example with these different type of standards that I have with the Republican Party, then, like I said before, nothing's able to stop us.
All right, Amel, I'm going to have to go to you. Get a different perspective from the Howard University Democrats. What have you been doing?
What have I been doing?
Programmatically to reach out to your fellow students.
We've been doing so many things. One of the things we've been really utilizing is the social network Facebook. I think Senator Obama's been absolutely ingenious in the fact that he's really tried to get our age group engaged in this political process by having, like, different Facebook groups. And through these Facebook groups, we're able to send messages out to students to let them know that we can go canvass for Senator Obama, or that they can volunteer at the local Obama headquarters, which is, like, two blocks away from our school, by phone banking, but also helping with data entry sheets. Some other programs that I've been planning, on October 25th and November 1st, we'll be going back to Virginia again to do some more canvassing, because, as you know, Virginia is such an important state, and it hasn't been Democratic since the early 1960s. And if you look at the Gallup polls and things, you see that the race is really, really close, and right now he's leading. And we really need to bring out people in Virginia to make sure they vote. So,
Mary, you're in California.
Yes.
And although we saw Governor Palin here for a rally, this is a solidly blue state overall.
Yes.
What difference does voting make in that case?
Well, I mean, I think that just because something is supposedly solidly blue doesn't mean that you shouldn't still go out and cast your vote. I think the whole process is important. Obviously, there are also local elections going on, so there's that. And I think also just the whole practice of going out and participating, that's something. It's interesting listening to these young people talking, because so many, there's so many outlets for them in terms of educating them on the process. For a new voter such as myself, it was really difficult to, first of all, learn what the process was. During the primaries, I had not a clue what was going on. And it can be very confusing and somewhat intimidating, especially for people who at one point were not engaged in the process while living in this country And then suddenly are legal, are citizens, and are able to go and cast their vote. So you start to say, well, okay, you get this big, thick book and you think, whoa, I have to read all of this. And then finding out about the issues, finding out about the candidates, where to go to cast your vote. It can be very confusing if you're not part of the system already.
Did you find yourself in the end turning to the official guides, which you bring up, or to friends or to nonprofits? Where did you go?
Interestingly enough, during the primaries, I did start by asking a lot of my friends and was shocked to find out that very few of them understood the whole process themselves and that a majority of them did not vote. So that was really shocking. And that actually encouraged me to get more involved. And so I did contact the Obama campaign, and I did work as a precinct captain and just sort of jumped right in to find out what was going on, how things worked. I mean, I didn't know what a superdelegate was. I didn't know any of that stuff. And, you know, right now, trying to find out about the Electoral College and how is it possible that you can have the popular vote but not win? How is it possible? I mean, there's so many things that when you're not brought up in this system, as so many new citizens are not, or even if you are brought up in the system but are not able to vote, and so therefore you tune out certain
things. Or even if you're able to vote, but they don't have civics class anymore.
That's true, too.
Well, that's why we're doing our month-long series on voting, and so we're going to try to hit as many of those topics as possible. But I want to open this up to Reginald. Considering that there are many fewer Black Republicans than Democrats, how do you go about shaking the trees and trying to bring people together?
Well, my thing is I've always believed quality goes a lot farther than quantity. You go to Howard University, our organization has grown from one person to two people to now we have almost 30 members of our organization. And we've had such experiences that have, like, that most college students aren't able to experience, being that we've had the local GOP reach out to us and allow us to basically use them as a networking tool. We've been on BET a couple weeks ago, registering people for the John McCain campaign. Today, I'm here on NPR, speaking on national radio. And I think that right there just it's a testament to what can be done, no matter how many number of people you have. Just know that, you know, if you have the willingness and you have the hard work in you, anything can be possible.
Amel, when you think about this election, and how old are you, may I ask?
I'm 20 years old.
You're 20
two
years.
Two decades.
Okay. Yep. Two decades. A lot of people had to wait a long time for an election this historic. It happened to come at a very good time for you, when you could vote and while you're still young. What does it mean to you to be a part of this election?
It means so much to me. I was recently having a conversation with someone, and I told them, I said, you have always been the catalyst for change. I said, if you examine history, even if you examined our parents' age, the hurdles that they had were included the civil rights and the Vietnam War. And I said, even though our challenges are a little bit different, the thing is it's in our nature to be rebellious. And I said, so we can be rebellious in the fact that we can actually get out and vote, because it's been shown that our age group just doesn't care. And so I'm just so excited to be a part of this movement, and it's really, really inspired me. Before this election, honestly, I was an apathetic to politics. I've always kept up with politics through great news shows like Talk of a Nation and All Things Considered and C-SPAN. But the thing is, it's just I've always been very cynical. But after reading Senator Obama's book and saying that there can be something new in politics, I became inspired. I said, well, since I can see the Capitol and the monument behind in my dorm room or in my dorm window, maybe I should go intern for them. And so after I went to go intern for Senator Harry Reid, and Senator Obama's office is actually located on the 7th floor, it just opened up so many opportunities. And I'm just so excited to be a part of a movement and hopefully change the course in politics.
All right. We're going to have to wrap it up there. But Reginald, I know that you also have had a lot of contact with the system. Both of you very engaged. And Mary, always great to see you. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Amal Bennett Judge, president of Howard University Democrats, and Reginald Derby, the vice president of the Howard University Republicans. They both joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C., plus Mary Nanama Dankwa, a newly naturalized citizen and author who lives in Hollywood. She joined us from our studios at NPR West. And next on News and Notes, hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons on working to mobilize voters. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Queen Latifah tells the New York Times she doesn't care if people think she's gay. Jennifer Hudson's debut album comes in at number 2 on the Billboard charts, and Russell Simmons tells us why so many people are plugged into what celebrities say about voting. We've got Newsweek magazine's Allison Samuels sifting the rumors from the truth. Hey, Allison.
Hi, how you doing?
I am doing great. So earlier in the week, we chatted with hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons about his various efforts, and he does wear a lot of hats, to get out the vote. And we also asked him about his call to celebrities to encourage voting, even though some of his friends are disqualified for various reasons. Mm-hmm. Here's his response.
Each one of us does the best we can with what resources we have. Many of us only have celebrity, and we use it the best way we know how. You know, every person who has a good intention counts, and if they don't make it to the polls themselves, but they inspire others, then good.
So what do you think about that? Some celebrities have been either disqualified for, say, felony voting issues, mm-hmm. or just not so enthusiastic about voting to bother registering, but have done PSAs. Yeah. Sounds like Russell is saying that that has value. What do you think?
I mean, I think it does have value in the sense it shows that the celebrities are thinking beyond themselves. And I think that's the thing that we haven't seen over the last sort of 10 and 15 years with celebrities. I remember famously Eddie Murphy told Arsenio Hall he'd never voted. And I think that that's discouraging. It sort of says you're so removed from the regular person and the regular world that this doesn't impact you. And I think it's interesting to have rappers like T.I. and people like that say, you know what? No, I care about you. So you need to vote. Because you're my fan, and if you're struggling, you know, it is going to have a full circle effect on my celebrity. So I think it just shows an intelligence to say, I can't do it, but you really need to.
Now, Russell Simmons is an Obama fan. Mm-hmm. There's something very interesting. Democrats have been criticized or lauded or both for using a celebrity strategy. When we asked a Republican strategist about the GOP's use of celebrities to reach out to African Americans, we got a surprisingly candid answer. He said, it's just not our style. If we attack Obama's use of celebrities on his campaign, we just can't turn around and use them ourselves. What do you think of the idea that, you know, celebrities for the Democrats, that's their style, Republican spokesperson saying, not so much for us?
Well, I actually think Democrats, and like with Obama, I know that a lot of the celebrity people who support him, it's not because he's, you know, encouraging them to support him. That is just, you know, the way it happens to turn. And Hollywood has been traditionally very liberal and very Democrat. And I think, as Russell said, you have to use what you have. But I also know that someone like Obama has been hesitant to use people like George Clooney and Tom Hanks, who really wanted to come out and do more publicity for them and him and get out there and actually get the vote. But he's been hesitant because I think he's being careful about, you know, people sometimes can take that the wrong way. It can help you, but it also can hurt you if you have people out there who are not at all relatable to the average person. And so I think that's the sort of tricky situation that, you know, a candidate can find himself in. But I think for liberal Hollywood, which is, you know, liberal, they've always gone for Democrats, and I don't think that's going to change.
Somebody here on staff, and I will let the guilty be guilty silently, said that Obama's going to have to appoint a minister of black persons, just to control everybody who wants a favor. Like, I want to stay in the Lincoln White House. I want this. I want that. Hang out with me.
Wow.
A minister of blackness. Do you think there should be a minister of hypocritude?
Well, I actually think that Michelle can take care of all of that. That's what I think. I think, when I see Michelle, I think she can handle all those other little things that are bothering her husband. I think she'll be perfectly capable of handling that. But, I mean, he is going to be a different kind of president.
All of a sudden, I have an image in my mind of Michelle just, like, whipping out some kung fu and just not knocking people's sides.
But I could just see her just being very clear. He can't do that. He can't do that. And he won't be doing this. I mean, I think that is going to be one of the things that, you know, she'll be very good at. So, I mean, he's going to be a different kind of president. People are going to expect different things from him. And it is going to be interesting to sort of watch how he sort of navigates that, because it's going to be tricky probably.
What about a McCain presidency where it ain't over till it's over?
Right.
If Senator McCain wins, black celebrities just go back to rhyming and singing?
Yeah, I think there's not much to – I mean, I don't see where black celebrities will have much to say about McCain. He just doesn't bring that excitement, that spark, that interest, I think, to sort of, you know, the creative types and the Hollywood types or whatever. So, yeah, I think they go back to doing what they were doing before. But, you know, Obama gets them going, so.
Speaking of singing.
Mm-hmm.
American Idol flunky Jennifer Hudson's debut album landed at a remarkable number 2 on Billboard's chart. She has the highest rated R&B album by a woman since 2004.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a little bit of her song, Spotlight.
Are you a man who loves and cherishes and cares for me? Is that you? Is that you? Is that you? Are you a guard in a prison, maximum security?
All right, let's talk two things, the music and the chart. First of all, the music. Who is this for?
I think it's for anybody. I think, and definitely R&B fans. I mean, you know what I mean? I think that's the great part. This is the first really R&B album to come out to do really well on the charts by a woman. And I think, you know, it's those Mary J. Blige fans. It's people who really just want to hear great singing with good music. And I think, you know, this album does it. That's why it did so well.
What's the significance of it doing this well? Does it mark a shift in people's buying patterns of music, or just that she's a fan of people?
I think people really like her, but I think she also brings a shift because she, again, is not that traditional look. She's not the video girl with the slim, you know, figure. She's, you know, a regular looking girl with, you know, regular features. And I think if she can bring that trend back of, you know, as I tell people, if Chaka Khan or Aretha Franklin were to come out today, they wouldn't have careers. Because they, you know, we just don't support people like that anymore. So I think if Jennifer Hudson can come back and just sort of change that, it's amazing. And I think that's what she's doing slowly.
She is in The Secret Life of Bees with Queen Latifah, who we're going to talk a little bit about in a moment. Mm-hmm. But some people were saying her acting skills, her acting chops, not so great. What's the evidence so far?
Sex and the City, I didn't think she was great. I have to say that I didn't. I thought she was just ill-fit for that role. But with The Secret Life of Bees, she does a little bit better. And I think that's also because of the ensemble cast and her feeling comfortable and it just being a little bit more of her style of, you know, just her environment, I think, worked a little bit better for her. But, yeah, no, I think she's a much better singer than she is an actress. But, you know, again, Alicia Keys hadn't liked her before Secret Life of Bees in acting, and I thought she did really well. So I think it's just a matter of her growing to that point.
What about Queen Latifah? A recent New York Times article, Queen Latifah says she doesn't care if people think she's gay. Mm-hmm. And since, you know, we human beings have a tendency to pry into other people's business, there has been any number of articles of speculation saying, oh, she's dating her trainer and, you know, this, that, and the other. And she did, to my knowledge, DJ at a gay club, a women's club in New York City. What's the state of these rumors that she's even married, possibly, her longtime girlfriend, if that woman is her girlfriend at all,
say. Like, you know, the state, what I love about Latifah is because she is Latifah and she's been around for so long and she does her thing is that people sort of question it, but I don't think it impacts her career or her life at all, which I think is great because that's not always the case. I mean, she's been able to really do a great job of sort of, you know, just sort of getting around a lot of those questions. Obviously, she's been asked it, but she sticks to that same answer of, I don't have to answer that. You don't need to know or you don't have to know what I'm doing in my personal life. I think those rumors are going to persist until she actually says something. But I have a feeling she probably won't. I think, you know, particularly for African-American celebrities, it's just really, really tricky to come out and say that you're gay. And I'm not saying that she is, but I'm just saying that if that's just not something that an African-American celebrity can lightly go on and say and expect their career to sort of remain the same. That's just, you know.
Is this similar to the don't ask, don't tell military policy?
Pretty much. I think so. You know, because I think you can draw whatever conclusion you want from Latifah in her life. She's a beautiful girl. She's been out there for a long time. But, you know, she's just not going to talk about it. And I think as African-Americans, we all understand the difficulty of sort of telling all of your business and how that may come back to haunt you. So I don't think we're going to hear her come out.
But she will have an album come out.
She will. I mean, that's the one I actually just want to see her act. I really don't want to hear any more albums.
You're over her music?
I'm over the music. I think, you know, her time in music is gone. I think she's really, you know, worked out the acting thing really well.
Okay, on that note, thanks so much, Allison.
Thank you.
That was our entertainment news guru, Newsweek Magazine's national correspondent, Allison Samuels. She joined me in our studios at NPR West. In 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. organized the Poor People's Campaign as a cry for economic justice. Photographer Robert Houston was there covering the historic event for Life magazine. Now you can see Houston's Most Daring Dream exhibit at Morgan State University in Baltimore. For more, we have Aaron Bryant, curator of the Robert Houston exhibit at Morgan State University's James Lewis Museum of Art. Thanks for being with us, Aaron.
Oh, no problem, Farai. Thank you.
Sorry for making him a Houston for a second, like the New York street, not a Houston,
right,
like the city. So he has produced some of the iconic pictures of the 1960s. Martin Luther King giving the I Have a Dream speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial, images of Kent State. How did this man become such an able and adventurous photographer?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Mr. Houston was actually mentored by Gordon Parks, and anyone who knows photography understands the impact that someone like Gordon Parks had on the art historical discourse, but more importantly, using his art to have some sort of social impact and to make a social or political contribution. And so Mr. Houston was directly influenced by his mentor, Gordon Parks. And I think that's why we see such powerful images that really do address some of the issues that people are confronted with every single day, just as human beings, you know.
What's your favorite?
Well, there are a couple of them, actually. With this exhibition, we have about 55 images that we're presenting, but I had to go through hundreds of images, and most of these images were still slides that he had stored away and have been stored away for about 40 years since he took them back in 1968. I would have to say one of my favorites, though, would have to be the image of Martin Luther King. He took it in Boston. It was during a rally for the Poor People's Campaign. And you have King to the right of the image, and then you have microphones all the way to the left. And instead of having a white space, we often talk about white space in art, Mr. Houston has a black space. It's just darkness between the silhouette of Martin Luther King and these microphones.
He's in his 70s now.
Right.
What's he like as a man? Have you gotten a chance to talk to him?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've worked very closely with Robert Houston to put this whole show together. And I meet with him pretty frequently, you know, sometimes twice a week. And I meet with him so often, one of the things that I want to make sure that I do is sort of document each one of these photos. The kind of person he is, I mean, he's, if you look at his photographs, you understand that he has this innate ability to send this intuition for finding the dignity and nobility in every single person that he meets. And he has that same kind of dignity and nobility, but at the same time, he's very relaxed. And so it's amazing to me. I show him images that he hasn't seen in 40 years, and I ask him a question, and he remembers every single detail about every single person he's ever taken a picture of.
How is the exhibition organized?
Well, you know, the exhibition was actually a response to a couple of things. One, the Maryland Humanities Council issued a call. They wanted to do something in remembrance of King's, you know, the 40th anniversary of King's assassination. So they issued a call for grants and proposals, and we were able to get one of those grants. And the whole reason we wanted to do this exhibition in particular, it was sort of a response to Barack Obama's speech in Philadelphia in March 2008, A More Perfect Union. And so we sort of organized the exhibition to sort of address the same issues that Barack Obama sort of addresses in his speech. And the reason we did that was because we saw an important connection between what Barack Obama is talking about today and what King was talking about in the last few years of his life. So the images sort of tell that story of how King came up with the idea to do the Poor People's Campaign, to do, you know, it started with sort of like this anti-Vietnam sort of protest and how Vietnam was draining resources, much-needed resources, from social programs. And so we start there. And luckily, Mr. Houston has documented a lot of this stuff so that we can tell a complete story from the beginning of the dream, King's final vision, to the end when people were leaving and the National Mall had been flooded out, where Resurrection City and the protests took place.
What has he done recently? Is he still shooting photographs?
Yeah, he still shoots photographs, but he's pretty much retired, and he's been retired for a while now. But most certainly, he still works as a photographer. He spent most of his early life, of course, as a photographer for Black Star, and then, of course, the images that we have, he shot for Life magazine. Most of the images were never published because the whole event was sort of overshadowed by, of course, once King was assassinated, we had riots all over the country. And then, of course, Bobby Kennedy's assassination. And so many of these images were never run. But he had always worked up until, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago as a professional photographer.
What does it mean to have this kind of an exhibition in the context of Morgan, a historically Black college?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because here we have these incredibly important, valuable, historic photos about what seems to be a forgotten time in history and an important transition in the civil rights movement, when civil rights moved from just voting rights and desegregation and civil rights to issues of human rights, health care, education, access to jobs and housing, affordable, decent housing. And so it was an important transition in American history, an important transition in civil rights history. And considering that these photographs were taken by Mr. Houston, a Maryland native, he still lives in the same house he was born in East Baltimore. It was really important, I think, that a state entity sort of take claim of this exhibition and to present it, you know, publicly. But it's even more important that a university like Morgan State University, that has an amazingly rich history here in Baltimore, that we present it. You know, some of the top Black politicians in the state all graduated from Morgan.
Well, Aaron, thank you.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Farai.
Aaron Bryant is the curator of Most Daring Dream, Robert Houston's Photography, and the 1968 Poor People's Campaign. The exhibit is now at the James E. Lewis Museum of Art at Baltimore's Morgan State University. To see some of Houston's photographs, check out our blog at nprnewsandnotes.org.